Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we look ahead to 2017 in a variety of different areas. We'll talk to a constitutional law expert about the possibility that President Obama, as one of his final acts, could grant a mass pardon to undocumented immigrants. We'll also look to the world of health care and learn what's coming in the new year with Emily Baser of California Healthline and Kaiser Health News. That and what's the outlook on the weather? Is California's drought in our rearview mirror? Meteorologist Sean Boyd will join us later in our program. We begin, though, with a story that's likely to be in the headlines throughout 2017. Plans for a new dam on the San Joaquin River above Millerton Lake are on a collision course with a separate proposal from the Bureau of Land Management that would designate a portion of the area as a wild and scenic river. Conservationists say it would save some rare land while improving public access, but supporters of the dam say the designation would essentially kill the project. What does the incoming Trump administration mean for the reservoir? FM 89's Ezra David Romero reports.
Spelunker Paul Martson and I are crawling into a cave system a mile or so east of Millerton Lake along the San Joaquin River. The Millerton Cave system is more than a mile long and was carved out by an underground stream running over granite bedrock.
But you can see how the rock has been carved into fantastic shapes by the water over hundreds of thousands of years probably. It would take another 100,000 years to recreate it.
Spelunkers from around the country travel here to meander through the cave system. But the caves are in trouble. If plans for a reservoir called Temperance Flat are approved, the caves would sit several hundred feet underwater.
We have something that's so unique to this area, and we're going to destroy it in favor of crops that we already have surplus of. And that just seems like a tremendous shame, because we've got gazillions of oranges, and we only have one cave like this.
Even still, Temperance Flat is being touted as a reservoir that could help solve the California water crisis. It'd be sort of a reservoir within a reservoir upstream of Millerton Lake. It'd increase the capacity of both Fryant Dam and itself to 1.5 million acre feet. Extra runoff from really wet years would be captured, creating water storage that farms and towns could tap into. Tulare County Supervisor Steve Worthley says the project is needed, especially for farms and towns on the east side of the valley hit hardest by the drought. Worthley says the new presidential administration could move the project forward faster.
We think that this incoming administration may be more resource-oriented and a little less preservationist-minded than some of the previous administrations.
That's a dig at the Bureau of Land Management's proposal to preserve an area of the river as wild and scenic. That 7-mile strip of river is in the reservoir area and would need federal approval. If the river gets the designation, it would make it nearly impossible to build the reservoir. Worthley also thinks a proposed $3.3 billion reservoir could be used to create a system for year-round groundwater recharge.
Instead of just trying to hold water back as much as you could, you would, as the opportunity presents itself, release water into recharge basins that already exist, and certainly many more that could be developed.
It's not just farmers in Tulare County that support the project. Mario Santoyo is with the California Latino Water Coalition.
At the end of the day, you really have to weigh out, what is the value of this large project produce to the broader population versus the loss of some individuals?
Farmers like Zach Stuller and Ivanhoe say the potential extra water from Temperance Flat would alleviate his need to pump groundwater. Today he's pumping well water into giant ponds that he'll flood his fields with to keep his oranges and mandarins from freezing.
To do what we're doing here, my wells are running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to keep this reservoir full, and I'm only irrigating a quarter of the time.
Stuller says if there was a year-round flow of surface water to his east side farm, he wouldn't have to pump groundwater at all. Even though Stuller thinks Temperance Flat is a good idea, he's also a little skeptical. He's only for the project if it's cost-effective.
Any dam that we can get built in this day and age is a good thing. But I want it to be the most efficient process and for the farmers to get the most bang for their buck. I don't think that we should spend billions and billions of dollars and not reap the benefits of it.
Stuller isn't the only person skeptical of the project not panning out financially. Pacific Institute scientist Peter Glick thinks a reservoir isn't worth the environmental or economic cost.
It's a massively expensive project that effectively produces a tiny amount of new water that can be allocated on a river that's already grossly overallocated. It's hard for me to even think of any pros.
Another person that hates the idea of Temperance Flat is Anita Lodge. Her great-great-grandfather set up camp along the San Joaquin River above Millerton Lake in the mid-1800s.
He was walking up the canyon hunting, and he ran into a gold miner, and he traded his rifle for the gold mine. Then he went back and got his wife, and they moved up here, and they lived actually on the claim.
The family never left and built homes along the San Joaquin River. Today, the lodge's two-story rustic home is surrounded by public land. As she refills her wood-burning stove with logs, she says Temperance Flat would basically drown her house.
I can't believe they would even be considering it. It makes me sick. It's been so much a part of our legacy. This has always been the central hub of our family, and it would be lost.
It's still early for the project to get a green light, but the Bureau of Reclamation will have a final feasibility study and an environmental impact report out sometime in 2017. The Bureau of Land Management has already released their first study on the Wild and Scenic River proposal, and now it's up to the next administration to decide which direction it goes. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. It's been over 2 years now since California voters approved Proposition 47, a measure which recategorized many drug and property crimes from felonies to misdemeanors. It's one of a number of big changes in California's criminal justice system in recent years, and even 2 years later, it's still controversial. While it has reduced the state's prison population, some say it's led to an uptick in property crimes. Others say it's still too soon to know about the law's full impact. So what do we know about the law 2 years in? That's what journalists from four California newspapers sought to find out with a new investigative report, Freed But Forgotten, the Prop 47 Project. It's the work of the USA Today Network California, including the Desert Sun, the Ventura County Star, the Record Searchlight, and the Salinas Californian. Joining us now is one of the journalists involved in the project, Jill Castellano, an editor with the Desert Sun. Jill, welcome.
Welcome. Thanks for having me.
The title of your series, Freed But Forgotten, hints at one of the major takeaways from your project, that the support services for these people just isn't there in many cases. Give us an example of the problem and its scope. What's exactly going on here with the people who are now out following Prop 47?
Well, if you want an example of the problem, you can look at the lead character in our story, who I think totally exemplifies what's going on here. His name is Ruben Lopez. He was in prison on a third strike back when California had very strict three strikes laws. So his third felony, he was sentenced to a life in prison because he had 1.8 grams of meth. He wasn't selling, he just had it on him. And he was sentenced to life in prison for that. Well, now under this new law, Prop 47, you can reduce that crime to a misdemeanor. So all of a sudden, he doesn't even qualify for three strikes. And after 20 years in prison, which he served from 1994 to 2014, he was let out. So what that means is he's out on the streets with no help and no support. And he's just kind of walking around trying to figure out what to do now. So it seems like Prop 47 is this great thing that's giving people their lives back. And in a way, you know, it's freed him from incarceration. That's absolutely true. But he's not back on his feet. And when you talk to him, he doesn't say Prop 47 was great. He says, Prop 47 did nothing for me. At least when I was in prison, I had a regiment. I had something that I did every day. Now I can't find food. I don't have a home. You know, he's living in his cousin's auto shop. And he doesn't think that Prop 47 has has been successful. And a lot of the people we've talked to are the same way. You can see the scope of this problem by going to Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles. You know, you start talking to people down there and you'll realize that, there are a decent number of them who have been affected by Prop 47, because these are people who have committed a lot of low-level drug crimes or property crimes that are now classified as misdemeanors. But just because those crimes have been reclassified doesn't mean that anyone's, you know, necessarily better off.
Do we know how many people out there are like the gentleman you just told us about or others? Do we even have an idea of how many people have been reclassified under Prop 47?
That's a really good question, and we wanted to answer this and found out that it was actually really difficult to do. If you go to the state of California and ask them how many people have had felonies reduced to misdemeanors under Prop 47, they'll tell you, we don't know. So what we had to do to answer this question was to go to all of the counties, the 58 counties in California, and ask them, do you keep records? Do you know how many people have petitioned your county to reduce felony convictions under Prop 47? We were able to get records from 21 counties, and we were able to estimate that for the state, 198,000 felony convictions have been retroactively erased by Prop 47.
Again, we're talking about this new reporting project from a number of papers here in California, including the Desert Sun. Jill Castellano is an editor with the Sun and joins us today on Valley Public Radio talking about the impact of Prop 47. You write that there's a number of other things that we know now about Prop 47 through your reporting. Drug busts are down. Drug arrests
That's
are down.
Right.
Tell me a little more about that.
Well, it's fascinating. So we analyzed data, 10 years of data collected by the Attorney General's office on every crime, every arrest in California. And what we found is that there was a huge, significant, statistically significant drop in drug arrests in California the year after Prop 47 compared to the 9 years before Prop 47. In 1 year, there was a 9.5% drop, which is unheard of in California for drug arrests, 22,000 fewer people have been arrested on drug crimes. And these are all sorts of drug crimes, meth, heroin, cocaine possession, all these hard drugs that were downgraded to a misdemeanor. Cops are not even bothering anymore. You know, we did the interviews, we talked to law enforcement around the state, and what they're saying is now that Prop 47 reduced these hard drug possession crimes to a misdemeanor, I can throw someone in jail, I can arrest them, you know, for meth or heroin, I can throw them in jail. But they're going to be back out on the streets very soon. It doesn't change anything, and it's not worth it anymore.
One of the other things that supporters of Prop 47 said in the arguments for the measure back in 2014 was this would result in savings to the state. Do we know if that's actually turned out to be true?
Well, it's actually quite controversial at this point. Yes, it did result in savings, but the amount of savings is up for debate, and where that money is going is still sort of up in the air at this point. So Prop 47 advocates, when they were pushing for Prop 47 and trying to get voters to pass it, they did promise the law would save hundreds of millions of dollars in prison costs, because you have all these people who were in jail who would suddenly, in prison, who would suddenly get freed. So the state wouldn't have to pay for them anymore. So it would save all this money. And they specifically wrote in that proposition that a portion of that money had to be spent on rehab programs and programs to help people, you know, with substance abuse issues and to help people get back on their feet and avoid the prison system in the future. Well, what's happened now is that there's a dispute over how much money was actually saved and how much money is actually going to go toward those programs. So the Legislative Analyst Office for the state says that $130 million were saved in the past fiscal year because of Prop 47. But the state estimated more around $30 million. In total, they're only putting about $67 million into their Prop 47 fund. Now, that fund exists and the money's in there, but even so, none of the money has changed hands. None of the savings have gone to any programs yet to help people with mental health or substance abuse issues, like the law said.
One of the other things you mentioned in your report I found surprising. You said many people don't know about Prop 47 or don't know about their rights that are restored to take advantage of some of these things. What's going on there? Because don't they have to apply in this case to have their crimes reclassified from felonies to misdemeanors?
You'd think so. But what can actually happen is that a public defender can apply on your behalf. The person who was handling your case originally can go ahead and put in a petition on your behalf. And what happened is originally there was a tight deadline for when you had to file these petitions by, these Prop 47 petitions. And all these public defenders were concerned that they wouldn't be able to file all of them on time if they had to go and talk to their talk to the people that they're petitioning on behalf of. And so instead, they just decided not to tell these people and go ahead and file petitions for them just to make sure that they could get them in by the deadline. The deadline has since been extended, so we've got years before we need to worry about that again. But what the result of that has been is we know that there are people out there who have no idea that their convictions have been reduced to misdemeanors under Prop 47. And so they can't take advantage of the benefits of having that felony off of their record, because they have no idea that it's gone.
In your reporting for this project, did you come across any success stories? You've told us about some of the people who feel that Prop 47 let them down, or the state didn't provide some help in the transition from prison to civilian life. Are there success stories out there that you can point to?
Oh, yes, definitely. And it shouldn't be overlooked that there are success stories, because Prop 47 is helping people get felonies off of their record that follow them around. And a great example of that is this woman we interviewed named Ingrid Archie, who she was laid off from her job because she had a felony on her record. And her job was, you know, the stability in her life. And suddenly when her company developed this new policy of no longer hiring felons, she lost her job and she had children to support. And so she started, you know, stealing from convenience stores to support her children, stealing diapers. Eventually, she ended up arrested and back in the system because she didn't have a job. While those convictions that she ended up back in prison for, she was able to reduce under Prop 47, and then she got out early. And since she got out, she has been a huge advocate for Prop 47, saying that, you know, it's given her a second chance. Now that she's back, she's going to straighten her life up. She's going to get her kids back, who have been estranged from her for a while. And now she has a new job, and now she has her kids back. And she's a big advocate for how Prop 47 can help people and how everyone should take advantage of the opportunity to reduce those felonies.
Now, there are also critics of Prop 47 from another camp. Some in law enforcement say it has led to, in some cases, an increase in certain crimes, property crimes and things like that. What did you find along those lines in your research?
Absolutely. Yeah, this has been a question that was nagging at us since the beginning, since we first sat down and decided we wanted to pursue this project, because you know, the reporters who originally talked about it said, well, we keep hearing this from law enforcement. We keep hearing this thing about property crime going up and, you know, crime going up, and all these people who got out on Prop 47 are not doing anything except, you know, ruining society in some way or another. And we wanted to verify those claims. So we did the data analysis on violent crime and property crime to see if that's really the case. And at this point, it's more of a debate about whether that's true or not. So property crime did climb in California from the year before to the year after Prop 47 by 8%. And so we know that there was a little bit of an increase, but criminology experts say, you know, there's no direct link to Prop 47. We don't know for sure that that's because of Prop 47. We do know that the largest contributing factor to that rise in property crime was an increase in car theft, and car theft was not affected by Prop 47. So there's no direct link that we're seeing right there. But what police will say is, you know what? It's just the beginning, and we're going to continue to see in future years that property crime is going up, that these people are stealing, that they're, you know, they can't hold a job, that they're just delinquents, you know, lifelong delinquents. But if you look historically at the data in California, if you look at since 1980 onward, you can see that property crime has plummeted to these all-time lows. And these little increases we're seeing now are, you know, almost non-existent if you look at the graph for 30 or 40 years worth of data. So we, you know, we recognize their concern, but we have no way to confirm that these small property crime increases are connected to Prop 47.
You can find links to the stories on our website at kvpr.org. Again, it's called Freed But Forgotten. It's a project about Prop 47 from the USA Today Network California, including Jill Castellano with the Desert Sun. She's an editor there and one of the forces behind this new investigative project. Jill, thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. 2017 is likely to bring a lot of change in a number of areas, including healthcare. While it's still too early to say what a lot of those changes might be, some are already becoming clear. And to tell us more, we have with us on the phone Emily Baser of California Healthline's Ask Emily column, which runs online and in newspapers across the state. Emily, welcome.
Thanks, Joe.
You've written two recent columns about changes that are coming here in 2017, including some big changes to Medi-Cal, also what the change in healthcare means for undocumented immigrants. Let's start with the Medi-Cal column, your most recent one, and changes to rules regarding the death fee. What is the death fee to start out with? What are we talking about?
Sure, Joe. There is a very controversial program called the Medi-Cal Estate Recovery Program. And what that means is that if you are a Medi-Cal enrollee who is over 55 and you die, the state can go after your estate, essentially, and try to recoup the costs of your care after you were 55. And obviously, this is something that has made people very, very anxious. They're very concerned that, you know, that their heirs are going to have to owe thousands upon thousands of dollars after they die. I can get into more details if you'd like, but it has been a very controversial program over the years, and California has gone after more costs than most other states. It has gone above and beyond the federal minimum, which only a minority of states do.
Now, when it comes to nursing home care, as I understand it in California, Medi-Cal is the provision or the program that runs that, even for people who otherwise wouldn't be Medi-Cal recipients otherwise?
That's right. Medi-Cal pays for most nursing home care because it ends up costing so much and people just don't have the funds for it. So, yeah, that is true.
So what's changing and why?
So there has been a long-fought battle in the legislature over several years to try and change this program and bring California back to what the federal minimum requires. And so that is what is changing, actually. Under the legislature changed the rules for people who die on or after January 1st. So if someone unfortunately passed away in December and was a Medi-Cal enrollee over 55, this does not pertain to him or her. However, if you're over 55 and you have Medi-Cal and you die after January 1st, now the state is very limited in what it can go after your estate for. And the federal minimum basically says that the state can only try to recoup costs that are related to nursing home care and something called home and community-based services. And these are things like adult day health care. There's a pilot program that is testing the use of assisted living as a Medi-Cal benefit. But again, you know, in the past, the state could even go after the managed care fees, the monthly managed care fees that it paid on your behalf to insurance companies, even if you didn't use those services. And now, for most people, it can't do that unless those fees are related to nursing home care.
So in the whole, statewide, what type of money was this program and this fee recovery effort generating?
It wasn't as much as you would think, given that the Medi-Cal program is so massive and covers more than 13 million Californians and multi-billion dollar program. In 2015-2016, this program collected about $70 million.
And what is that expected to change with this new program? How much of a percentage change is it? Is it a dramatic one in total, or is it one that's relatively this portion of that?
You know, I asked state officials about that, and they didn't want to speculate on that. There is one question mark, Joe, that I do want to add, and that could affect how much is recouped from enrollees. Under the old rules, Californians who used in-home supportive services, which is where these people are Medi-Cal eligible and qualified to get some money to help pay for an in-home caregiver. Under the old rules, the state could not try to make a claim against your estate for IHSS costs. IHSS is the short name for in-home supportive services. But under the new rules, that's a big question mark. The state seems to think that IHSS may be one of these home and community-based services, and advocates strongly disagree with this because this would expose potentially hundreds of thousands of people to new Medi-Cal estate recovery claims, and they are promising that if the state does this, they will take them to court.
Again, we're talking with Emily Baser of California Healthline's Ask Emily column. She writes about probing questions about the healthcare industry that are posed by readers and others throughout the state every month. Her most recent column is about the new rules to limit the Medi-Cal, quote-unquote, death fees, or to limit those. There's also another column that you wrote after the election about the connection between the potential changes to healthcare and the Affordable Care Act and immigrants, specifically undocumented immigrants in the state. On the surface, one might think there's not much that would change there because under the Affordable Care Act, undocumented immigrants are not eligible to receive coverage, at least in the base principle there. What do you find in your talking with people there?
Yeah, actually, Joe, there are a lot of unanswered questions in this area, just as there are about the Affordable Care Act, as you and your listeners know. In California, immigration status and health care coverage are linked very closely. California has taken some steps to provide certain immigrants who otherwise wouldn't be eligible for coverage, to provide them opportunities. So, for instance, in 2016, last year, the children of unauthorized immigrants, so children who were in the country illegally, hadn't previously been eligible for full Medi-Cal benefits, but the state decided to change that and offer them full Medi-Cal benefits, and more than 150,000 of them have signed up. Now, the state could do this only by using completely state money on this, no federal money for this. And so you might think, oh, okay, so this is just state money. Those kids will be able to keep their coverage regardless of what happens in Washington, D.C. We don't know. Really, we just don't know because federal lawmakers are actually talking about significantly changing how they pay for Medicaid programs across the country, such as Medi-Cal. And so if they significantly alter that and funding is reduced, the state may not be able to afford to do that kind of thing anymore.
You also have some undocumented immigrants in California that were able to obtain full-scope Medi-Cal through the PRUCOL program, the Proof of Resident under Color of Law. It's a rather obscure provision, but it's been used extensively here in Fresno County after the county abandoned its prior obligation to provide specialty health care services to undocumented immigrants. The county wound up signing up a lot of people towards that program, and they essentially had to say that they were here in the country, the government knew they were here, and they weren't taking active steps to deport them. Could that also be in jeopardy now?
Yes, that. You're talking about the DREAMers, the DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, is that right?
That would be that, and also other undocumented immigrants who are here. Again, there's a number of these different provisions, but just
right.
in general, that's another thing that's also potentially a change here.
Right. You know, I mean, and speaking specifically of the DREAMers, that's what I did a little bit of reporting about. You know, President Obama in 2012, by executive order, created this program that would allow these young people who were brought into the country by their parents illegally, would allow them, like you say, to have work authorization. It defers their deportation for 2 years, and it can be renewed. And for these youth, they were eligible for Medi-Cal as well. They couldn't purchase a plan from Covered California, which is the health insurance exchange, but they became eligible for Medi-Cal. And there are more than 200,000 of these young people who have that status. But again, big unknown here, because President-elect Trump has said, has vowed, in fact, to eliminate all of President Obama's executive actions on immigration, to actually immediately terminate them. So if he does that, you know, these youth, a lot of them are very concerned not only about their immigration status, but then that also means, you know, what happens to their health coverage. So that's a big unknown. In California, the lawmakers and advocates are talking about, well, if these young people lose their DACA status, does that mean that they're going to lose Medi-Cal? At first, advocates thought so, but now they're saying we just don't know yet. So
another thing there is with this overall talk about changes to health care, the changes weren't just on the consumer end, they were also on the provider end, the way hospitals and others got compensated for coverage changed dramatically, especially in areas here in the Central Valley where you had a lot of hospitals serving underserved communities and things. Is there a buzz right now in the healthcare community from what you hear about what type of changes or what the impact of changes might be on this, the way the system now works, which is so different than it was, say, 10 years ago?
Oh, goodness. I mean, that is such a huge question, Joe. I think, and you're talking broadly,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Are people talking about this at this point, or is it just
wait
and see?
People are talking about it, but of course, so much of it depends on what action is taken at the federal level and how, let's say, that Congress does decide to, I don't even want to say repeal Obamacare, because more likely than repealing Obamacare would be that they gut certain pieces of it through the budget process, which is something that they can do more immediately and easily than repealing the whole law. And so questions range from, you know, okay, if they do this, and for instance, if they cut the subsidies, the federal subsidies that have been basically allowing people to buy plans through Covered California because they've lowered the cost of premiums, if those subsidies end, what happens to Covered California? What happens, more importantly, to the people who purchase the plans on Covered California? Will they just have to pay out of pocket? You know, so many people just won't be able to afford that. And what's going to happen to health insurance premiums? I mean, there's a lot of buzz about the premiums, you know, skyrocketing. But again, so much of this depends, as I mentioned earlier, even Medi-Cal, you know, here in California, we expanded the Medicaid program, which is Medi-Cal, under Obamacare, and now about a third of Californians are on this program. If what happens to those people who got on the program if that piece of Obamacare is eliminated? There are just so many huge questions, because these are paid for by federal dollars, and California probably doesn't have that much to spare to just keep it going. So there's a lot of anxiety and questions, but it depends a lot on what the federal government does.
And we'll be following what happens through Emily's column. Again, we're talking with Emily Baser of California Healthline today. Her monthly Ask Emily column appears in newspapers up and down the state and also online at californiahealthline.org. Again, she joins us today talking about what 2017 might bring in the world of healthcare. Emily, thanks so much.
Thank you, Joe. My pleasure.
This is Valley Edition. President Obama is taking big steps in his final days in office, like banning oil drilling in the Atlantic. Now both friends and critics alike are asking if he might use his executive authority for another controversial issue, a potential pardon of undocumented immigrants. But how might that work? Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess spoke with USC law professor Niels Frentzen about the constitutionality of such a decision and how it might play out in the real world.
Is it within the president, in this case President Obama's, constitutional power to do a sweeping pardon, like a mass pardon of everyone who's living in the country without the proper documentation?
There is disagreement on that, and you know there is a argument as to why it would be possible. But you know it is definitely not something that has been done in this context before. But I think there's that he probably would have the authority to do this. It would probably be something that would be challenged in the courts, and ultimately the Supreme Court might have the final word on it. But I think there is a basis in the Constitution to do it.
Explain that argument. What is that argument, and why do you think it has some merit?
Well, I mean, traditionally, the presidential pardon power has been used for people to pardon individuals who've been convicted of federal crimes or individuals who've committed offenses who have not yet been, charged, who theoretically, could have been charged. And we obviously, one of the famous examples of that was, President Ford pardoning President Nixon for any crimes that he may have committed. The Constitution's language actually refers to the president having, and I quote, just pulled it up, power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States. And so there's nothing in the plain language of the Constitution that limits this to criminal offenses. And in the immigration world, if we want to talk about the 10 million, 11 million undocumented people in the United States, they are theoretically facing removal from the United States under civil provisions of the immigration laws. But those are arguably offenses against the United States. And so there is, and a lot of legal scholars are, of this opinion. It's certainly not unanimous, but that the president would have the authority to pardon individuals for civil violations of the immigration laws, which would arguably then make those individuals immune from being deported, on those specific grounds.
How would this be possible? You said 11 million-ish. How would it work if we don't even know how many people are living here undocumented, what their names are, what their addresses are? How do you issue a pardon if you don't even know a person's name?
Well, that's a legitimate question. And, there would be a question as to whether or not a pardon has to specifically say that Niels Frentzen, USC professor, is pardoned for any immigration offenses, or whether it could simply say, define the population. Anyone who is not a U.S. citizen who entered the United States on or before, and I'm, just making this up, January 1, 2016, and who is potentially subject to deportation from the United States for one of these reasons. Would that type of presidential pardon where the president is defining, the class of individuals, if you will, that might be perfectly acceptable. We saw, we do have a history in this country of mass pardons, the last one that I am aware of, and I don't know if this was the first one or not, but the last one, or the one example that I can think of, was President Carter issuing a presidential pardon for individuals who were draft resistors during the Vietnamese War, and that was a blanket pardon. I don't believe, even though I don't know this, I don't believe that Carter's pardon for the Vietnamese, either both resistors as well as deserters, I believe. I don't believe that pardon enumerated, listed the thousands of men, young men, who were covered by it. I think it was just a blanket declaration to that effect.
But in the same way that the immigrants would be grouped into a classification, a class of people, it would work in the same way.
That is the argument. And I think, the other thing that's worth mentioning, I suppose, is there are, in the Immigration and Nationality Act, the federal immigration law, there are 50 or 60 distinct reasons why a non-citizen can be deported from the United States. And so one would not expect, and I don't think anyone is asking, Obama to say, pardon every immigrant in the United States, who is potentially subject to future deportation from the United States under any of the 50 or 60 grounds of deportation that exist. I mean, you can be deported from the United States because you've engaged in genocide. You can be, deported for, having been convicted of a murder, for example. And so, I think the ask, if you will, from immigration, immigrant advocates is to, again, for this to be a very broad-based pardon, but for it to delineate, certain specific grounds of removability as they're known, entering without inspection, overstaying a visa, things like that.
I don't think it's a stretch to say that if he did do this, it would be a pretty remarkable exercise of presidential authority.
It would be a pretty remarkable event. And certainly, I know in his, in President Obama's various exit interviews, he is indicating he's not going to be doing this. I know several of his top immigration advisors have said they're not, he's not going to be doing this. I know the Attorney General said he's not going to be doing this. So, but again, as you said, things could change, but it would be, remarkable. Now, having said that, the constitutional authority and, in Article 2 of the Constitution, giving this authority to the president, it's arguably, I don't know if I can say it's completely immune from judicial challenge, but it is pretty much an absolute power that is given to the president.
What's the counter argument? Because you said it's not a 100% consensus that he could do this. What's the argument that someone would make to say that he couldn't?
Well, I think the primary argument is that the pardon authority is limited to, to criminal charges. And then I would have to know more about, I don't know the specifics of the Carter pardon for the Vietnamese, deserters and draft resistors. But if that was something where there was actually a list generated, there would be, perhaps an argument, again, not based upon any, statutory language, because the pardon authority is constitutional and it's defined in the Constitution. But there then might be an argument that, if you look at the way this power has been exercised in the past, it does require individual naming as opposed to defining a class.
That's Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess speaking with USC law professor Niels Frentzen about the constitutionality of a potential decision by President Obama, if he so chose, to pardon people in the country illegally. This is Valley Edition. As California's drought continues to drag on, what's the weather outlook for 2017? Forecasters are predicting a major storm this week as El Niño has been replaced with La Niña out in the Pacific. But what does it mean for you? Meteorologist Sean Boyd, who is a lecturer in Fresno State's Department of Geography and City and Regional Planning, joins us today on Valley Edition to talk about all of it. Sean, welcome.
Oh, welcome. It's good to see you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too, and very exciting for people who are watching the weather. Before we get to the storm that's on the way, and potentially it's a big one, where are we right now this rainy season when it comes to precip here in the valley.
Sure. Did a little analysis about this last night, and this is yesterday's date. So the most tangible thing that most people in Central California want to know is, how much rainfall have we had thus far, and where does that compare to average? So I took four selected cities in the valley: Merced, Fresno, Hanford, Bakersfield. And for the sake of argument, I'm going to go by what's called the water year, which is from October 1st to September 30th. To sort of avoid the latent controversy over the rainfall season, which is July 1st to June 30th, which is another topic, which we're not going to get into today.
Yeah.
But just for the sake of consistency, I'm going to use the water year. So since October 1st, I'll take Merced first for those of you in the North Valley. 4.25 inches of rain since October 1. The average for that three-month period is 3.5. So that's 120% of average. Fresno, we've had 4.56 since October 1. The average for that is 3.5, so we're at 131% of average. Hanford has had 2.87 inches of rain since October 1. The average for that three-month period, October through December, is 3.13, so they're 89% of average, a little bit below average. Bakersfield, which really is an interesting locale for a number of reasons, but they had their third wettest December on record. It just finished up 3 days ago.
Wow.
Mainly because of what happened the last day of the month. They just the storm that just gave us a tenth of an inch of rain on Saturday gave them over half an inch and very low snow levels. So Bakersfield has 3 inches of rain for the three-month period, October, November, December. They normally would have in that same three-month period 2 inches of rain. So they're 154% of average. So why then is Hanford on the shy side compared to these other three cities? Because most of the storms have not favored the West Valley, because what happens is when air parcels come in from the Pacific sometimes, if the air above your head is coming in from the southwest, that tends to rain shadow the west central San Joaquin Valley. And so the storms that we've had have favored the East Valley, and then last minute, you know, in the wane hours of 2016, the South Valley. We're talking, you know, southern Kern County. So that's where we stand, generally a little above average for the water year to date from October 1st to the present.
And better than last year at the same time.
Yes, and better than last year at the same time. Now, let's talk about something that's a little bit more tangible to water managers, which is the combination of solid and liquid precipitation that has fallen in the Sierra in that same period. And the water people divide the Sierra up into three regions for that purpose. There's the Northern Sierra 8-station index. In other words, 8 places where they've been taking these measurements for decades. There's the San Joaquin part of the Sierra Nevada, where there's a 5-station index. And there's the Tulare region, the 6-station index, which stretches from about Balch Camp to Lake Isabella. So the Northern Sierra 8-station index for the water year-to-date is 167% of average.
Pretty
and
good.
You're thinking,
very
whoa,
good.
Well, here's the deal. October was the anomaly. In the 8-station index for October, typically they get 3 inches of liquid precipitation. In this past October, they got 12.5. Boom. And that was because of very warm storms that came into Northern California, which seemed to go from the Bay Area right up the I-80 corridor.
So what's it like a little further south?
A little further south? Okay. The San Joaquin 5-station index is 116% of average.
Okay. Inching downwards, but still above.
Tulare is a 6-station index for the Tulare region of the Southern Sierra Nevada is 125% of average. So overall, well, you take those three into account, we're at about 136% of average in terms of liquid that has come down since October 1.
But is all that snow? I was up in the mountains around Huntington Lake this weekend, and there was snow, but there was less than I remember years ago at the same time, even in a wet year.
And that's the issue is, you know, how much of that came down and stayed in the form of solid water as opposed to liquid water. And that's a very good question, because that's obviously something that people who manage watersheds.
Yeah, and we'll have to wait for the snow survey and some of those things.
You know what? I'm glad you mentioned that, because as of the most recent snow surveys, which are barely being taken. Now, some of the agencies have not gone into those snow courses yet because of the storm. So some of them may be going up today. But as of New Year's Day, most of the snow surveys were pending, but through January 2nd, which is just yesterday, with the measurements that have been taken so far, The snowpack was at 67% of historical average for the date, January 2nd, and 23% of the April 1st average, which is a benchmark for how much water is going to come down in the form of liquid, you know, once the season is over.
Okay, so we have a few minutes here, and I want to get through a few more things.
Sure, sure.
La Nina. Everyone's been talking about El Nino for the last 2 years.
Yep.
Now it's gone. When all of a sudden we have La Nina now, when did this happen, and what does that mean in real terms?
By matter of definition, briefly, El Nino is when the equatorial Pacific Ocean, just west of South America, is warmer than average. La Nina is when the equatorial Pacific Ocean west of South America is colder than average. Now, we had a very strong El Nino 2015-2016. The northern third of California managed to get above average precip. The central part of the state, some of it was average, some below average, and the southern part really didn't get a good benefit from the El Nino that has now passed. Often when an El Nino is over, it switches back to a La Nina, where it gets colder than usual along the Pacific Ocean near the equator west of South America. Now, it did swing that way, but now it seems like it's neutral because the sea surface temperatures, the last I checked, west of South America are only about 4/10 of a degree Celsius below average.
So that's not a strong La Nina.
No, it is not. But the current weather pattern, which is evolving adjacent to California and North America, is beginning to mimic a lot the La Nina pattern. So, you know, does it mean if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, is it really a duck? We'll have to see. But one of the things that I know you're going to do is you're going to post some graphics.
We already have them
you.
Up on KVPR.org.
Good.
They're up right now if people want to check it out. And talking about this current storm that's on the way.
Yeah, so that people can sort of visualize what we're talking about here. Because after all, you're painting maps in your head right now, thousands of you, I know. And that's the way radio is, and that's a good thing. Can we talk a little bit about drought?
Yes, a little bit. We've got about 3 minutes left.
Okay, so I was looking at the U.S. Drought Monitor last night. A year ago at this time, 45% of California's dirt was in what they call D4, which is the highest category of drought. As of last night, as of December 27th, 18% of the state is in D4.
Okay.
So there has been
better.
Some improvement. Now, almost all of Kings and almost all of Tulare and almost all of Kern counties and San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara, Ventura counties, almost in their entirety, are in D4. But there's been some improvement in Fresno County. What does that mean? This takes into account things like surface water storage, soil moisture, precipitation thus far compared to average, and projected precipitation, if you can do that. So we should not let our guard down. As William Carl said, when I saw him over a year ago, yes, it will eventually rain again in California. You know, he's the one that wrote that book in 1982, Water and Power, if you remember that book. Yes, it will rain and snow again eventually in California. And the next 3 to 7 days, I'm telling you, some of the computer models are projecting astounding amounts of rainfall in the next 6 to 7 days and accumulated snowfall in the crest of the Sierra and especially the west-facing slopes. Perhaps by next Tuesday morning, between now and next Tuesday morning, as much as 25 inches of liquid precip at the crest of the Sierra. If that happens, we could be talking about some significant flooding issues in parts of northern and central California in the next 3 to 7 days. If the models verify, and they've been very consistent the last 3 days in painting that picture on the maps.
So too soon to say that this is a drought buster or anything like
that.
I'd
be a fool to say that.
Yeah, but this is a significant, potentially significant storm that we should be watching out for, and the trend seems to be going in the right direction.
That is correct. If you want to look at current watches and advisories, for instance, there is, and I know time is running out, but I can if I can get it here, it's coming up on the screen. There's a flash flood watch for our nearby foothills. There's a winter storm warning above 7,000 feet for the next storm coming
in. What's the timing look like on this storm?
It looks like it's going to start moving into the northern third of the state during the day today and then sag down into central California tonight and tomorrow.
Well, we'll have to get out the galoshes and umbrellas and hope that there's a lot of snow up there in the Sierra.
That's the hope.
Sean Boyd, meteorologist and lecturer in Fresno State's Department of Geography and City and Regional Planning, joining us today on Valley Edition. We hope that this is something that can put a big dent in California's drought. We'll have to wait and see what happens. Sean, here's to a good 2017. A wet one.
Yes, I vote for that.
All right. Well, that's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to invite you to go to our website, kvpr.org, and check out our archives and streaming audio there. Also, send us an email, talk@kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.